Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Heidi Miller, registration 33923, with the Adams County Attorney's Office on behalf of all three defendants. This is an appeal about qualified immunity, an often misunderstood but critically important aspect of Section 1983 litigation. Former Chief Judge Lewis Babcock summarized qualified immunity very articulately. Discretionary decisions by government actors inevitably impact the lives of private individuals, sometimes with harmful effects. Moreover, such decisions are inescapably imperfect. Qualified immunity thus allows officials the freedom to exercise fair judgment, protecting all but the plainly incompetent or those who knowingly violate the law. And that's from Sanders versus Jefferson County, citing, of course, the Malley versus Briggs U.S. Supreme Court case. The importance of the qualified immunity defense is particularly important in the realm of child welfare. Child welfare, there is no formula to handle child welfare cases. Each one is different, and each case requires a magnitude of decisions that are made daily on behalf of these children. From the decision to remove the children from the biological home in the first place, all the way through, all the decisions that are made about therapy and placement in schools.
Not unlike decisions made by parents.
Correct, Your Honor.
Indeed, the relationship is very much the same.
It is, Your Honor. But parents can't be sued in this forum under substantive due process for mistakes that they may have made in the decisions they make about their children. And what this case has illustrated is that when cases like this are tried in the civil courts, everyone has an opinion. Everyone has an opinion about every one of those decisions that were made. And those opinions differ greatly.
But let me try to cut through that for a minute.
Sure.
Are we reviewing the factual record that was assembled in the context of the summary judgment, or do we go back to the allegations in the complaint or amended complaint, whichever it was, and take those as true? Because this is an interlocutory appeal of a denial of summary judgment. And in Brace versus Lakewood and some of the federal cases, they indicate that in the unusual circumstance of an interlocutory appeal of a summary judgment denial, the reviewing court doesn't second guess the facts. It simply looks at the legal questions of, you know, has a constitutional violation been properly pled? And if so, does it rise to the shock the conscience level?
Your Honor, I would argue that the concept of not reviewing the facts is really more intended to say that you should not second guess the trial court's factual determinations.
Okay, well, there's three levels we could look at. We could look at the facts as pleaded. We could look at the facts as found by the trial court, and then we could look behind the facts as found by the trial court at the summary judgment record. Which of those three are you saying we should do?
Your Honor, I believe that if the trial court made factual findings, you do have an obligation for this interlocutory appeal to uphold, to use the findings that she had.
But the well-pleaded allegations of the complaint simply fall away?
I believe so, Your Honor.
What case would you rely on to say that we can, in this unusual interlocutory setting, we can disregard well-pleaded allegations by the plaintiffs?
Your Honor, I really do not have a Colorado case that would hold that, other than to say that there are many federal cases, including many of the ones cited in the briefs, that analyze qualified immunity based on the summary judgment standard and particularized facts that are proven or in the record.
But aren't those cases all in which the summary judgment was granted and therefore an ultimate appeal is inevitable, whereas here you've got a summary judgment denial?
You're right, Your Honor. I cannot right now think of a case in an interlocutory appeal.
Thank you.
We would argue, though, that the judge made her decision at a summary judgment standard. Summary judgment had been pled, and her decisions to deny qualified immunity were made based on those standards. And so it's only fair that you review her decision to deny qualified immunity based on the same evidence that was before her.
Did you dispute? I recognize this is not your argument, but do you dispute that the plaintiff sufficiently pled, if we take their allegation, if we accept their allegations, constitutional violations that shock the conscience?
I do, Your Honor. I believe that even when you review the complaint as pled. There are no actual facts alleged that any of the women, any of these three defendants, Joan Forsmark, Catherine O'Donnell, or Angela Lytle, had actual knowledge of harm to children and took action that put those children in that harm.
Actual knowledge required as opposed to awareness of circumstances that a reasonable professional judgment would require action?
I believe you're correct, Your Honor. If these women, given information available to them at the time, had knowledge that those children could have been in danger, then yes, they had an obligation to act.
You're saying that the amended complaint doesn't even acts to rise to that level?
It does not, Your Honor. I mean, when you take a look at the allegations and the facts that are alleged by plaintiffs, they're taking information that we have today in 2011 and interposing that information on decisions that were made going back to 2000. So yes, today we know that those children alleged they were sexually abused in their biological home, but that information was not available to these workers at the time. And so I think even if you look at the facts as alleged, that the timeline would tell you that the allegations of harm that these children suffered, none of that was known to the defendants when they were making their decisions in this child welfare case.
As of January 03, didn't the defendants know that these children were alleging sexual abuse in the Staley home?
They did, Your Honor, but I believe even if you look at the allegations, you'll see that the defendants took immediate action. The children were already out of that Staley home. Catherine O'Donnell made sure that the children had no further contact with children or the parents of that home. Adams County pulled every child out of that foster home, never put another child in that home. So, yes, they were aware of danger, but as soon as they were aware of danger or potential danger, they took immediate action to protect these children. So to say today those children should not have been placed in that home is assuming that they had knowledge that that home was dangerous at the time.
What about the fact that there's at least been an allegation, I'm not sure if the trial court made a finding, of spoliation of evidence concerning the Staley home file?
Your Honor, the trial court did not make a finding until after the trial. She waited until all evidence, the issue of spoliation was argued at trial, and an adverse inference instruction was given. But that was not addressed in the responses, in the orders on summary judgment. Our argument with regard to spoliation for this particular issue is...
Don't the summary judgment orders reference the fact that that file is gone, even though there is no formal finding of an adverse inference?
They do, Your Honor.
You don't dispute that the file went MIA after the lawsuit was filed?
We don't know if it was after the lawsuit was filed, but definitely the file cannot be found. Once it was requested in discovery, it could not be found. But the point is...
That the department had reports that would raise a concern.
They did not deal with these children, Your Honor. Any of the reports that the reconstructed file we were able to pull off of the electronic systems were prior to these children being placed in the home. And all I can tell you is that unfortunately there are allegations of abuse in foster homes quite often. They're investigated. In this case, they were investigated by another county because this particular foster home is actually located in Jefferson County. So Jefferson County did all the investigations of abuse in that home. And if they had found abuse, that home would have been shut down. That did not happen. They remained an open, certified foster home. And Ms. Forsmark, as the worker for the children, didn't have an obligation to go back and research the history of that home. So even if we had the file, even if the file showed there had been allegations, Ms. Forsmark's obligation is, okay, I know this is an open home. My department has said I can place children here. And then it's her obligation to supervise those children and make sure that they're safe in that home. And there were never any outcries of abuse in that home while these short children were there.
Did the trial court make a specific finding that Ms. Forsmark's responsibilities concerning that home, including the placement of the children there, were a disputed factual issue?
She did, Your Honor.
Don't look behind that. Doesn't that alone mean that for purposes of summary judgment, we must give the plaintiffs the benefit of the inference that she knew or could have determined that this was a dangerous place?
Well, I believe that the plaintiffs have an obligation at the stage of summary judgment to identify particularized facts in the record. And bald allegations that have no support in the record, when all of the evidence in the record from Ms. Forsmark's deposition and the deposition of the foster mother, Penny Staley, it was clear that she was not the certification worker for that home until 2003, after the children had been removed from the home. Plaintiffs attempted to confuse that issue, and apparently the trial court misunderstood. But if you actually look at the record, it is clear that Ms. Forsmark was not the certification worker for that home.
But don't you concede that for purposes of our review, trial court found summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the trial court found that there was dispute, but if you look at the citations that she made, it's clearly an error by the court.
But it isn't an error that you concede, given the unusual.
Your Honor, I believe that you have the opportunity, because you have a full record in front of you, to correct that type of error. If I may, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Jordan Factor, bar number 38126. We are not here on an appeal of the trial court's determination of facts. We are here on the very limited issue of whether the operative law was clearly established at the time of the alleged violations. And the law was clearly established that a social worker who fails to exercise professional judgment is liable under Section 1983 if she does so in a dangerous situation and there is a link to injuries sustained by a child in state custody. The trial court's legal determination was correct and should be affirmed, and the county's attempt to take a very limited appellate jurisdictional issue and expand it into a de novo review of the summary judgment record is improper and should be rejected. Ordinarily, denials of summary judgment are not susceptible to immediate appellate review. A very limited exception was carved out by the Colorado Supreme Court in Brace for denials of qualified immunity. The court in Brace directed trial courts to perform a two-step analysis when determining qualified immunity. First, a trial court is to determine whether the law is clearly established. Second, the trial court is to determine whether issues of material fact preclude summary judgment. The Brace court expressly held that only the first part of the analysis, whether the law is clearly established, is subject to interlocutory review. The second part of the trial court's analysis, a factual determination under Rule 56, is not appealable until after trial, as is the case with all denials of motions for summary judgment. So we are here solely on the question of whether the law was clearly established.
Taking your amended complaint allegations is true.
Yes, Your Honor. Taking our amended complaint allegations is true. Now, it's not crystal clear from the case law whether the court restricts its view to the amended complaint or also accepts all the facts as stated in the district court's summary judgment order. It's absolutely clear that the court does not look behind the summary judgment order into the summary judgment record. However, I would suggest that it's the better appellate practice to look at the complaint, given the number of cases that suggest that issues of qualified immunity should be resolved as early as possible in the litigation. That would seem to suggest that the appropriate universe of facts is that set forward in the complaint and not providing an opportunity for the development of the factual record. However, what's clear is you do not engage in a de novo review of the facts in the record. You do take the well-pled allegations as true. Yes.
How do you respond to your opponent's assertion or challenge that your complaint relies upon information that was learned after the fact? You know, once it was, you know, these children cried out that they had been sexually abused and that, you know, we shouldn't be looking at what they knew later on.
Right, that is an inaccurate characterization of the facts. It's certainly, if all you do is you take the complaint at its face, you don't look beyond the face of the complaint to their suggestion that the facts are not as they were pled. So the facts as pled amply support a finding that the law was clearly established. The law that was alleged to be violated was clearly established. However, even if you were to look at the underlying facts, what is clear is that at the time of placement, the history that was known to Defendant Forsmark was a history of an institution that was woefully inadequately supervised. There were reports that it was out of control, is one quotation, that it's too much for the parents, another quotation, that they'd lost it, another quotation. The mother was a registered child abuser. There were two reports of child-on-child sexual abuse. There was more than one report on average each year of abuse or neglect in the Staley home.
Adams County Department of
Justice. These are in the Adams County reconstructed certification file. Your Honor, everything that I've just said is in the certification file that we were able to reconstruct. Obviously, there's a lot of information that we were not able to reconstruct because the file was destroyed after knowledge of its relevance following the GIA letter being issued. Defendant Forsmark was the last custodian of that record. This issue was known to the trial court prior to entry of summary judgment. The trial court had decided to wait on an adverse inference instruction while it provided the county one last opportunity to find the file. It subsequently did not do so, and a powerful adverse inference instruction was offered. But the facts that I'm describing are in the Adams County records that we were able to reconstruct. And it painted a picture of a foster home that was inadequately supervised. Now, why this is important is because the Jefferson County investigation, to which Your Honor referred, into the abuse of these plaintiffs resulted in Penny and Dan Staley being placed on the central registry for inadequate supervision. In other words, Jefferson County concluded that these plaintiffs were injured as a direct result of inadequate supervision, and that inadequate supervision was well known to the defendants prior to placement. So that is a classic application of the special relationship theory contained within Yvonne. As Your Honor pointed out earlier, the rationale behind the special relationship theory is that when the state removes a child from her parents' custody, the state becomes that child's parent and has a duty to care for that child as a parent would, because that child is vulnerable and is utterly dependent upon the state for help. Therefore, what the Tenth Circuit said in Yvonne is, number one, children in the custody of the state have a substantive due process right to be kept reasonably safe from harm. Moreover, a state is liable for a violation of that substantive due process right by a third party if the special relationship test is met. The special relationship test is laid out in two parts. Number one, that a state official knows of a dangerous situation, or, and it's clearly disjunctive, or fails to exercise professional judgment with respect to a dangerous situation. And second, there is a link to injuries sustained by the child. That's absolutely the case with the placement in the Staley foster home, that there were dangers that were known, or Forsmark failed to exercise professional judgment with respect to these constellation of facts that suggested the danger, and there is a link to injuries suffered by the child in the inadequate supervision. Now, the Tenth Circuit applied Yvonne specifically in the context of foster care placements in the Yvonne case itself, but it is applicable and has been applied beyond the area of foster care placements. And of course, it's well established that to be clearly established, the law, there need not be a prior case with, you know, facts directly on point to the present case. Rather, the state of the law need only place a reasonable official on notice that the Constitution governs their conduct, and government officials are required to make reasonable applications of the law to their present circumstances. So with that in mind, the 10th Circuit in the Johnson case, which is also cited as a state of Kano, took the Yvonne case and applied it to a situation where a social worker named Villarreal, and I mentioned the name because there are a number of defendants in that case, but Villarreal failed to investigate the arrival of a foster parent's father in the home, the removal of the child from daycare, the firing of the child's home health care nurse. Those were the unique constellation of facts in that case.
They rely on Kano since it was decided sometime after the operative events here?
Yes, Your Honor, you cannot rely on Kano for the purpose of saying that it clearly established the law, but you can rely on Kano as instructive for how the law that was clearly established could be applied in different circumstances. That is, we're not arguing that Kano put these defendants on notice that their actions were implicated by the Constitution. So that's not the argument. But the argument is that Kano reveals the breadth of Yvonne, and Yvonne itself is the law that was clearly established. To put it another way, Kano did not purport to establish new law. Kano merely sought to apply Yvonne to another factual circumstance. The clearly established law was Yvonne. And in Kano, the 10th Circuit said that it's for a jury to determine whether those facts amount to a violation of Yvonne. Same thing with the various ways that we've alleged violations of these children's clearly established constitutional rights. It's for a jury to determine whether by not only placing them in the Staley home, but by pushing through an adoption that, you know, followed immediately on the heels of revelations of incest and child prostitution and child pornography in the biological home, where the caseworker insisted that the adoption be delayed for 6 months and established placements for the children in Fort Logan. The supervisor, Defendant Lytle, came in and overruled her caseworker's determinations and insisted that the adoption go forward to parents who were not approved by the county for children with even mild to moderate emotional problems.
Let me ask you a couple questions about Lytle specifically. It's argued that Lytle did no more, you know, point of view, I suppose, but what Lytle did is merely allow a circumstance to continue. So how was it that the children were any more at risk after the Shirks adopted them than they were in the Shirk home, you know, a day or a week or a month before the adoption? Well, in other words, what is it? And I assume your theory against Lytle is danger creation, not special relationship.
It is both.
Okay. Well, let's look at danger creation. What was it that Lytle did that created a greater danger than the children were already subjected to before they were adopted?
Because the revelations of this abuse created a unique psychological environment where the children were decompensating and were at risk of great psychological harm and were in need of emergency interventions precisely because of the revelations that took place, precisely because whether they were suppressed memories or whatever else, they came forward and they needed help in that moment that they didn't need a day before.
Okay, but your theory against Lytle doesn't seem to be as much as she didn't give them help if she just let the adoption go forward or even pushed it forward.
No, Your Honor. O'Donnell
arranged... I meant Lytle.
No, you did say Lytle, Your Honor. O'Donnell arranged for that necessary help to be in place. She arranged for the emergency response team to come in. She arranged for placements of the children in Fort Logan.
So she arranged for the children to be separated so they couldn't abuse each other, and you're saying Lytle overruled that?
Precisely.
And is that specifically alleged in the complaint?
I don't believe that is specifically alleged in the complaint, Your Honor.
Looking at the face of the complaint, isn't it just that Lytle either allowed or pushed the adoption ahead?
Yes, she did push the adoption ahead in dangerous circumstances. These are the facts that say what those dangerous circumstances were that was known to the trial court on the motion for qualified immunity. But yes, it's not specifically delineated in the complaint what the dangerous situation is. However, as I said, Your Honor, the theory against Lytle is not just danger creation. It is special relationship. And here you do have a circumstance where she either knew of a dangerous situation or failed to exercise professional judgment with respect to a dangerous situation, and there is a link to injuries caused to the children. So under the special relationship theory, we have a viable claim against Lytle.
Do the adoptive parents have a claim here?
No, Your Honor.
The sister
and the children? Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Factor, does your amended complaint contain an allegation or address the issue concerning providing inadequate mental health services to the children? It's my understanding that the social worker would engage in play with them, but I thought there was a recommendation that they actually get mental health services, which then, you know, potentially would have precipitated their disclosure.
Yes, Your Honor, that relates to the question of whether adequate investigation was done while the children were in the home that might have revealed the ongoing abuse, and the failure to provide investigatory services is, I believe, alleged in the complaint. I believe my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. The purpose of a qualified immunity interlocutory appeal is to ensure that government workers like the defendants do not have to stand trial when the law is not clearly established that their actions were unlawful. And I would refer you to Eatson versus Owens. It's cited on page 10 in the opening brief. That was a denial of summary judgment based on qualified immunity, and the Tenth Circuit held that it should be a de novo review. The purpose of de novo review is that if we are not supposed to stand trial, if we didn't do anything wrong, you should have the opportunity to correct the trial court if she got it wrong. If she didn't apply the correct standards, for instance, we know that she applied a motion to dismiss standard in terms of a heightened pleading standard instead of actually having to plead facts, actually having to prove facts for summary judgment. If the trial court got it wrong, you should be able to correct it. That is the whole point of an interlocutory appeal, and it's what's fair to defendants in this case, that they should not have to stand trial if they are entitled to qualified immunity.
Your opposing counsel is correct that the only issue is whether the law is clearly established before us now.
How does your...
Your Honor, the only law that was clearly established at the time was Yvonne and Currier. And neither of those cases would have put these defendants on notice that their actions in this case...
Why not?
Because none of these defendants actually took action knowing that there was a possibility of harm. And if you look at the Yvonne standard, it actually does say knowingly place children in danger. And none of these defendants did that. Now, whether the certification file might have shown some history of danger, the point is that Forsmark is in the home every week. She is personally observing that this is a safe place for these children. She's not getting any reports from school. She's not getting any reports from kids. She's doing play therapy with the children every week. They're never drawing anything or playing anything that indicates they're afraid of the Staleys or that there's anything unsafe in that home. And quite frankly, this improper supervision, Penny Staley did not harm these children. The allegation is that they were harmed by a stepbrother in the home, and there were no prior allegations about that child or any other indication that would have put that caseworker on notice that these children were in danger from that child. Perhaps, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I guess I can't help. But I would point out that the appellees are incorrect about the qualified immunity standard and their generalization that because there's case law that says caseworkers can be held constitutionally liable, anything a caseworker does wrong, therefore, creates a substantive due process violation. And if you look at the case cited in the brief, Hilliard versus City and County of Denver, that case makes it very clear that the plaintiff must demonstrate a substantial correspondence between the conduct in question and the prior law establishing that, those actions were prohibited. None of the actions taken by these three defendants fall within those parameters where they would have known, gee, when I decide to place a child...
Errors of omission don't qualify, but errors of commission do?
Your Honor, I believe that an error of omission would require some pretty substantial facts to indicate that that government actor knew what they were doing could cause harm to that child.
Knew or should have known?
I think knew, Your Honor, because otherwise it becomes a negligence standard. And substantive due process and a conscious shocking standard goes far beyond what you maybe should have known. It goes to what did you know, and did you take the wrong action given what you had, the information you had at the time?
Very interesting case. It will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.